Italy has organized a webinar on females' inclusion in society. Human rights groups have slammed these initiatives as mere attempts to reshape the kingdom's image through expensive PR campaigns presenting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
The Crown has spent billions of dollars hosting major political, entertainment, cultural and sporting events as a deliberate strategy to deflect from the country's image as a pervasive human rights violator, to whitewash its dismal rights record.
Saudi Arabia is using the G20 meeting in Riyadh to build legitimacy. Bear in mind that bin Salman is behind the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The kingdom is cashing in on Donald Trump's staunch support all along the way.
Saudi Arabia is the first Arab nation to host the G20 summit, the meeting of the leaders of the world's most industrialized countries and emerging economies will be held on November 21st and 22nd. Max Civili, Rome.
A high-level conference focusing on the EU's treatment of refugees has just concluded in the European Parliament, Brussels. During the event, the 27-nation bloc's migration and asylum policy was slated. It appears a new crisis is emerging at sea as desperate African refugees try to reach EU territory.
Look what is already happening in the Atlantic. Hundreds of people are trying to reach the Canary Islands through the Atlantic, one of the most perilous routes in the world. They are dying there.
The EU unveiled a new asylum policy in September, but critics say the focus is on closing the bloc's borders instead of respecting international law and upholding the EU's much trumpeted values.
Our staff has spoken out against policies which are directly responsible for this unimaginable human suffering. Time and again, European nations and institutions have failed to act on their duty.
Many organizations insist the EU should be viewing immigration as an opportunity rather than a threat.
Behind all those people, there are hidden skills. We need to identify those skills and to use those skills in our European labor market.
The EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and several African nations to try and prevent refugees from traveling. During the Brussels event, Ankara was accused of using the refugee crisis to advance geopolitical goals.
It is wrong to endorse the popular view of Turkey as a victim of the war in Syria. Turkey is on war in Syria since its very last start.
However, Ankara is highly critical of the European Union over its handling of the problem. Refugees continue to die in the Mediterranean. Those who make it are held in very poor conditions on Greek islands and now Spanish islands too.
Perhaps the most compelling argument being made by rights groups for the EU to do more is because the West has fueled so much conflict in the Middle East and Africa, effectively playing a big role in helping to create the refugee crisis. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. I'm your host Ali Maysam. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is For Humanity. Now, yesterday we talked about the justice, that it's very important to establish justice when it comes to human rights. The first thing that we need to do is establish justice. Now, Tomorrow, on the Day of Judgment, the Day of Resurrection, anyone can turn around to Allah and say, Ya Allah, why are you punishing me? You didn't tell me to spread justice. You didn't tell me to establish justice. Where were these personalities who were supposed to teach me how to establish justice? The people can turn around to that person and be like, Habibi, Allah did teach you by sending personalities. Allah did teach you by sending prophets. Allah did teach you by sending imams or a'imma alayhimu salam to you. So that person cannot turn around tomorrow and say, Ya Allah, you didn't teach me nothing. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent a person named Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, as the first imam to the world. And let me also mention this, when it comes to Mawla Kainat, it does not just mean Mawla of the Shia, Mawla of the Muslim, Mawla of the Ummah. It's Mawla Kainat, which basically means the Mawla of the universe. It's just not the world, it's not the planet, it's universe, Mawla Kainat. So understand the difference. Mawla Kainat, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, taught the people what justice is. After the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, no one had ever better justice than Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. The judgment crossed the boundaries of justice and equality. This became so famous among the Arabs that became a saying, the case is there, Banu Abul Hasan to judge. Allahu Akbar. Amir al-Mu'mineen taught the people, and not just the Muslims, not just the Ummah, but Christians used to give the example of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. This is how just Amir al-Mu'mineen was. When it comes to this world, you see a lot of non-Muslims coming to you and asking you as a Muslim, well, where's the rights of a non-Muslim? Have your personality taught you about the rights of Muslims? Habibi, we can turn around to them and you can tell them, Amir al-Mu'mineen Nahjul Balagha, he says beautiful lines. He says, a person is either your brother in religion, in faith, or your equal in humanity. Simple. Amir al-Mu'mineen said these lines. No one ever dared to say these lines. No one ever said those lines. And no one will ever say these lines like Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam did. There are a lot of things, not just the Muslims, but the Christians, but the non-Muslims love Amir al-Mu'mineen so much that I'll tell you, there's a person named George Jordiak from Lebanon. He wrote a book about Amir al-Mu'mineen. What about it? He said, justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He said, if anyone, I'm just going to read a line from the book. He says, if anyone wants to see justice in one personality, look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib. Wallah, Amir al-Mu'mineen was a person that people loved him. Apart from Muslims, and this is very ashamed, the Muslims, not just in history, not in today's world, but Christians loved him, not just Muslims, but even non-Muslims loved him. And the people, like non-Muslims, like Kofi Annan, give examples of this person, like Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib. We all pray. Let's take a break for now. But before this break, let's pray that may Allah give us the opportunity to get a little justice like Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. We'll be right back after the break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is your host, Ali Maytham. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is For Humanity. Now, before the break, we did mention how there were non-Muslim personalities who did talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib. One of the examples that I mentioned was George Jordiak, that he wrote a book named Sawtul Idalatul Insaniya, which translates to the voice of human justice in English. Also, there were other people like Kofi Annan, who did talk about Imam Ali alayhi salam. So you see, not just the Muslims, but also the non-Muslims were inspired by Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. The question that you ask, why were people inspired by Amir al-Mu'mineen? The answer is very simple. Is because, not because of the position of Imam Ali, but because of the behavior of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, you see, the Holy Prophet, he announced the prophethood after 40 years. That's one of the examples. Why the people believed him is because Prophet proved the whole 40 years with his behavior. People used to call him a Sadiq and an Amin. The Prophet proved it with his behavior that when you see a person who is very honest, very truthful, and somewhere around you see that person is in trouble, your zamir doesn't allow that person is in trouble. You go to that person, you help that person, because that person has always been there to help you. And you're going to go there and help that person. Similarly happened in Mecca. People believed the Holy Prophet because he was Sadiq and Amin. So these were a few personalities who were the sets of examples who did talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib praising his justice. Now, before the justice, also there's one thing about humanity that I wanted to explain in low points. Is, you see, Inqilab Islami of Islam, of Iran, you see a lot of people go against it. I have a very simple point for them. Habibi, it's not important for you to be a Shia, to agree with the Islamic Revolution. You don't have to be a Sunni. You don't have to be even a Muslim. You don't even have to be a Muslim. You have to be a human to accept the Inqilab Islami. Why? Reason I'll tell you. America is killing your brothers out there in Yemen. America is killing people in Yemen. Forget the brothers. Forget the Muslims. Talk about the people. Talk about the humans. They're killing your rights. They're killing humans out there in Syria, in Bahrain, in Palestine, in Kashmir. A lot of parts that you see, these people are being damaged. These people are being killed day by day. Tell me which government, tell me which country dares to come out openly and tells America, down with the system of America. Down with the system. Down with the arrogance of America. Tell me any other country. Name it. I really can't find in history when I read the newspaper. It's very unfortunate that Iran always comes out to talk about the injustice. Why aren't other countries involved in it? Aren't other countries coming out and talking about the human rights? You see, there's the problem is these people hold a lot of ceremonies in their countries, like in America, in Europe, in London. Or let's just not mention like the Middle East, but let's just mention the Western countries. They hold their ceremonies naming what? Human rights, human rights, human rights, human rights. Habibi, you are the one who are violating the human rights. You are the one who are abusing the human rights. So don't talk about the human rights until you don't stop killing the people. So this is something very important to understand what human is. As I mentioned, human according to the Westerners is different. Human according to Islam is different. Now this is a difference you have to understand. Inshallah, we'll be carrying on this in the upcoming episodes. So that is it for today. You are just listening to IR, IB English Radio for Humanity. For more programs like this, you can actually visit our website, parstoday.com. And if you want to email us, feel free to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. With that being said, take care of yourselves. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil'alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fa bihim narjuka ahsin khatmina.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
On the news line.
The naval fleet of Iran Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft drones and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multipurpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid-Rudaki warship after martyred IRGC Navy commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since we have the Persian Gulf and actually the Caspian Sea in south and north of Iran, it has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries. U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. The tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war, because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States was not capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone the Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, be it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
Russia says the United States has deceived Moscow, and the international community after it conducted an advanced intercontinental missile interception test. Russia's foreign ministry says the exercise used technology that is part of the Aegis Ashore missile defense system, which the Pentagon had assured the Kremlin was not aimed at Russia's long-range capabilities. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson has described the development as quote-unquote a new confirmation of the dangerous and destabilizing character of Washington's anti-ballistic missile strategy and quote obvious anti-Russian orientation. Maria Zakharova says the test proved the falsity of American statements, saying, quote, "For many years, America assured us that the interception of Russian ICBMs by American standard systems, including this modification, is technically impossible." There are fears the test risks paving the way for Russia testing similar technologies against America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Moscow has already stated that it reserves the right to take the necessary response measure. On Monday, the U.S. military used the new advanced technology to fire, for the first time, a missile from a warship which downed an ICBM. Previously, the U.S. had promoted the weapons system as being limited against short and intermediate-range missile threats. Russia says this is direct evidence and a concrete example of how Washington manipulated public opinion of its country, lied to its international partners, and justified its actions in the international arena with far-fetched pretexts. Following the collapse of the INF and before the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the only remaining U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control agreement, New START, is also, as things stand, set to expire early next year. Moscow says it hasn't closed the door on negotiations to extend the agreement, formerly known as the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The projected U.S. presidential election winner, Joe Biden, has previously said he will explore the treaty's extension without conditions. However, bilateral relations between the two countries have always been on very shaky grounds. Analysts say the latest American missile test will only escalate military tensions. Amid Russia's worsening relations with NATO, it could not have come at a worse time. Questions have been raised as to whether the U.S. may use the system against Russian military interests. The weapon used to down the ICBM, the Standard Missile 3 or SM-3, is part of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Moscow has long suspected the system to be a major pathway to a U.S. global missile shield to undermine Russia's military power. The SM-3 missiles have also been deployed close to Russian soil, in Poland and Romania. Moscow says it has repeatedly warned it would take similar measures to ensure national security and maintain a strategic stability. Essentially, that means more sophisticated weapon systems deployed by the adversaries, while suspicions between the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and China on the other spiral out of control.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdel Latif Al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem outwards. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the regime to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
After months of chaos and hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide, an end to the crisis triggered by the deadly coronavirus pandemic could be within reach. U.S. biotech firm Moderna has announced its experimental vaccine against COVID-19 was 94.5% effective. The announcement would make it the second major breakthrough in worldwide hunt for an effective vaccine. Moderna has announced that its newly developed vaccine would pose no significant side effects.
At the end of this trial, if the efficacy dropped down to 80% or even 70%, this is still really a very good result and a really strong reason to be optimistic to have a vaccine and very soon vaccine.
According to the data provided by the company, its vaccine was given in two doses 28 days apart, and the preliminary results are based on 95 volunteers of the 30,000 who fell ill with COVID-19. Just last week, U.S. drug maker giant Pfizer, along with its German partner BioNTech company, announced the invention of a separate effective vaccine against the deadly virus. According to scientific reports, a key advantage of Moderna's vaccine is that it does not need ultra-cold storage like Pfizer's, making it easier to distribute.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, these are really good results, although they are interim result, early stages data, but yet these are really exceeding the expectation, because what we expected in the scientific community and also the regulatory bodies were that we will have a coronavirus vaccine around 60 to 70% effective, and this vaccine, both of the vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer results, are more than 90%, which
the vaccines are viewed powerful tools to fight a pandemic that has infected 54 million people worldwide and killed 1.3 million. The news also comes at a time when COVID-19 cases are soaring, hitting new records in the United States and pushing some European countries back into lockdowns. Next year, the U.S. government could have easy access to more than 1 billion doses just from the two vaccine makers, more than needed for the country's 330 million residents. Other European nations are expected to have easy access to the vaccines. Head of the World Health Organization has hailed the rapid progress towards a COVID-19 vaccine, but insisted that every country had to reap the benefits from the vaccines. Never in history has vaccine research progressed so quickly. We must apply the same urgency and innovation to ensuring that all countries benefit from this scientific achievement.
And I can announce that we have today secured an initial agreement
for 5 million doses of the Moderna vaccine.
Tedros Adhanom has said other countries could not wait for bilateral agreements to get the vaccine since the process could take years to negotiate. There are now concerns that richer countries could monopolize the distribution of the vaccine. Western nations have already ordered millions of the doses of the vaccine, potentially leaving poorer countries in Africa and Asia without supply for years to come. It's feared relatively wealthy nations will likely be able to vaccinate their entire populations.
The first agreement that we reached with the U.S. government was for an order of 100 million doses. So we anticipate to be able to ship up to 20 million of those 100 million before the end of the year. So we are making product, as you know, every day and stockpiling it. And assuming we get the green light from the FDA, I would say sometime in December, I'm sure General Perna from Operation Warp Speed will be ready with the trucks to load the product and to distribute it in the US via the CDC guidelines.
The EU has already ordered 200 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine, while the UK has ordered 40 million doses. People in low-income countries could be waiting until 2024. Drug-making companies could also benefit profusely from the world's deadliest pandemic in recent memory. Pfizer and BioNTech could make $13 billion from coronavirus vaccine.
In the limelight.
As Americans grapple with how or whether to gather with loved ones this holiday season, the roughly 2 million people confined in the nation's prisons and jails face an even grimmer challenge: how to stay alive inside a system being ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic. What you just heard was from an article authored by the editorial board of the New York Times under the heading, "America is Letting the Coronavirus Rage Through Prisons." Please stay with us for more of the New York Times article. It's both a moral failure and a public health one. Like the nation overall, United States correctional facilities are experiencing record spikes in coronavirus infections this fall. During the week of 17th of November, there were 13,657 new coronavirus infections reported across the state and federal prison systems, according to the Marshall Project, which has been tracking these numbers since March. The previous week saw 13,676 new cases. These are by far the highest weekly tolls reported since the pandemic began. With winter descending, the situation threatens to grow bleaker still. The American penal system is a perfect breeding ground for the virus. Squabbles over face masks and wearing masks and social distancing are essentially moot inside overcrowded facilities, many of them old and poorly ventilated, with tight quarters and with hygiene standards that are difficult to maintain. Uneven testing, inadequate medical resources, and constant churn off of staff members, visitors, and inmates further speed the transmission of the virus. Cruder still, inmates suffer disproportionately from comorbidities, such as high-level high blood pressure and asthma, putting them at an elevated risk for complications and death. 8 months into the pandemic, the precise shape and scope of the devastation remains difficult to pin down, but the available data is heartbreaking. As of mid-November, more than 196,600 coronavirus infections had been reported among state and federal prisons in the United States. More than 1,450 of those prisoners had died. The case rates among inmates are more than four times as high as those of the general public, and the death rate is more than twice as high. Inmates are not the only ones trapped with the virus. The correctional system employs more than 685,000 people. These are prison guards, nurses, and so on. There have been more than 45,470 reported coronavirus infections and 98 deaths among staff members to date. Their case rates are three times as high as for the general public. Of course, these are the reported cases. The real numbers are assumed to be higher. The coronavirus ripples outward from these hotspots, engulfing the families and communities of inmates and workers. The coronavirus does not respect prison walls any more than it respects state or national borders. It will not be confined. This spread poses a particular problem for rural communities. 40% of prisons are in counties with fewer than 50,000 residents, which typically lack the healthcare infrastructure to deal with such outbreaks. Even a modest outbreak can quickly overwhelm local hospitals with scant numbers of ventilators and intensive care unit beds. Local jails face additional challenges. Whilst prisons report much larger case numbers, the rapid turnover in jails, where many people are confined for only a few days or even few hours, enable the virus to circulate swiftly between inmates and the larger community, and makes tracking all that much more difficult. In a report last month on outbreaks in the Mountain West, the New York Times noted that in Cascade County, infections at the local jail made up about a quarter of all known cases in the county. Over 2 months, the facility knowingly released 29 people who were considered actively infected. As with so much about the pandemic, this is a problem that should have been dealt with more aggressively early on. There was a call for reducing overcrowding through early release and other decarceration measures. While some progress has been made, it has been uneven and inadequate. Prisons and jails experience declines in total population. Approximately 11% of the incarcerated population in the first half of 2020, according to a report on decarceration put out by the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. The report notes that these reductions appear to be mainly the result of declines in arrests, jail bookings and prison admissions related to lockdowns and the closure of state and local courts. It continues, the releases among sentenced jail and prison populations that have occurred have, for the most part, occurred on a case-by-case basis and have been procedurally slow and not well-suited to crisis situations. While many jails saw a population drop during the first few months of the pandemic, the numbers of people being held in jails began climbing again over the summer, according to a September briefing by the Prison Policy Initiative, which analyzed 4,451 county jails. In 88 counties, jail populations are higher now than they were before the pandemic, the briefing notes. Some states have taken legislative action to speed the decarceration process. A bill signed by New Jersey's governor last month permits prisoners with less than a year left on their sentences to be released up to 8 months early. This has already prompted the release of more than 2,000 people, with another 1,000 or more releases anticipated. All too often, though, continued foot dragging or dysfunction by prison officials requires the courts to step in. In the spring and summer, the San Quentin State Prison in California had a major coronavirus outbreak. Built in the mid-1800s and early 1900s, the outdated facility suffered from overcrowding, inadequate medical staffing, exceedingly poor ventilation, extraordinarily close living quarters, and inadequate sanitation, according to a panel of medical experts from the University of California at Berkeley, who were brought in to assess the situation at the prison in June. but by late July, the number of active cases had topped 1,600. Tents were erected to house the sick. Before the outbreak faded, around 2,200 inmates had confirmed coronavirus infections, and 28 inmates had died. In addition, 298 staff members were infected with the virus, resulting in one death. The problem continued to fester. In late October, a state appeals court ruled that the prison authorities' efforts to address the issue had been insufficient, and that inmates' constitutional protection from cruel and unusual punishment was still being violated. To deal with the emergency, the prison was ordered to cut its population by around one half through a mix of releases and transfers. It should be noted that the original outbreak was sparked by the transfer to St. Quentin Correctional Facility of infected inmates from another prison. Clearly, more needs to be done. The report by the National Academies outlines best practices for reducing the incarcerated population, broken down into short-term and long-term solutions. The suggested measures start with a systemic commitment to diversion efforts such as non-custodial penalties for minor infractions, including probation and parole violations, and the limiting of pre-trial detentions through means such as reducing or eliminating bail. In addition to offering guidance on a bolder decarceration effort, the report stresses the importance of minimizing risk to the families and communities involved, such as offering testing prior to release, a place to quarantine in the community, and examination of parole and probation policies and procedures. More comprehensive and more standardized testing and reporting requirements are also needed. Managing this kind of crisis is not a one-and-done effort. The report emphasizes it is a process requiring sustained engagement with a wide array of actors at all levels. It is all too easy for many Americans to ignore the horrors of what is happening inside the nation's prisons and jails. Inmates are isolated from the broader population, their suffering kept out of sight. But their welfare in this pandemic remains inextricably linked to everyone else's. The nation's continued failure to bring the coronavirus to heel among this vulnerable population is both a public health catastrophe and a moral one as well.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear sister.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. We wanted to discuss what are some important factors to remember whilst training children to be raised Islamically, and what we should be aware of, like the don'ts, what we shouldn't do, because we usually know what to do, so now maybe we should try and know what we shouldn't do.
Yeah, the don'ts, right?
Yeah, the don'ts.
The do's we know, like to love them is the do. Do love them, do justice, do enact justice, do not break your, for example, trust, or do not break your promise, or, you know, do love them and do take care of them. But now the don'ts, some of the don'ts I want to outline, you know, like briefly, in religious training especially, is don't do it harshly.
Okay.
Getting angry with the child and forcing him especially leads to this kind of hate and resentment in the child. He won't feel like doing that thing.
Definitely.
So it is better to explain the child, discuss with the child, of course. And of course, role modeling is the actual thing that affects the child in the long run. But if, for example, you have to explain it, don't do it with resentment. Mm. Or don't do it harshly. So explain and discuss in low tones. Don't.
Wait.
And then another don't.
Okay.
Is don't overdo it.
Okay.
You know, like for example, the prayer is so important. Now don't keep on overdoing it, keeping on and on explaining him, or keeping on and on telling him how this is also important and this mustahab is also important. Teach religion in moderate doses.
Yeah.
You see, overdoing it can be harmful and can be also a burden to a child.
Yeah, I think right now the kids, the way they say, unfortunately we hear it a lot, they say please don't preach.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
This is the
time. I don't want to hear a lecture now.
Yeah.
Because of the overdoing it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So a wise parent would always be very smart and when advising the child, you know. So children should not be made to recite a lot of du'as and, you know, mustahab prayers. If he is unwilling, of course.
Yeah.
Because if he's willing, that would be, for example, light upon light, I feel. That's the best
no,
way.
No,
so never force the child even to pray. If the child is very small, don't even force the child, even if they've gone to the mosque. Like, you know, I take my daughter to the mosque sometimes and I see her not praying.
Yeah.
And, or she prays without a scarf. And but she's very young, you see. So I can't force her.
Very true.
So I encourage her that at least she prayed one rakat namaz. Or you need a sajda. Oh, today why didn't you pray? That's it.
Yeah.
So never, never overdo it. Especially at that young age. And when they grow up to think and understand, that even is the time that you should not overdo it. Like whatever the compulsory set of prayers, let them perform it. But not that, now this is mustahab, but you want this, but you want Allah to listen to your prayers.
Yeah.
You can do it on behalf of them for the time being.
Okay.
And when they see that how you are role playing, then they will do it automatically.
So about praising the child, do you feel there is something like over praising? For example, is it that we should always praise our children when they're doing good, or should there like be a...
Yes, there should be a limit.
Okay.
In fact, praise for the need performed, not themselves.
Okay.
That's very important. And this is a whole topic altogether. So inshallah, in our future discussions, we'll bring that to the encouragement and praise factor, inshallah. So just now, we just want to briefly outline the don'ts in religious training especially, okay?
Okay, perfect, inshallah. So we'll get back to that after the short break. Please stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. We were discussing about the important factors whilst training our children and the don'ts. That's what you were mentioning. So you say that we don't have to do it harshly. We shouldn't force them. We should explain, discuss, and generally be a good role model so that they can just, you know, learn from our actions. And then you said, don't overdo it. We should try and be moderate. We shouldn't force them to do mustahabat because they don't really like the recommended acts. But we can encourage or praise to a certain extent.
Yeah. And another don't overdo it point would be that you also should not overdo it if they wouldn't like that from you.
Okay.
You know, sometimes the parent keeps on and on reciting duas and namaz and things like that, or goes on and on going from one gathering to another to, you know, take part in azadari, and the child is fed up.
Oh, that's very
interesting. Mother is not there with me.
Yeah.
Or the child is fed up that she can't talk to the mother because she's always praying and doing dua. Mm. Or she's always in the tasmeen.
To be balanced.
So balance, yeah, yourself. But if the child doesn't mind, it's another thing. Okay. But some children actually do mind. It's like when you take a mobile and you keep on chatting and the child wants to talk to you, you'll feel like throwing the mobile away, right?
Yeah.
So it's like that. Like, of course, this is talking to Allah. And we all have our pleasurable moments with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through namaz and dua. But if the child does not like it, then don't make him feel that this is what Islam wants from
yeah.
me.
Or don't, because maybe then the child will not like the action then.
Yeah.
And wouldn't like to do it in himself.
Yeah, exactly. He'll feel that this is what Islam calls for.
Yeah.
You know, being so like, oh, you know, just in your own world and just talking to Allah. You can do it in your other private moments also. There are ways also.
Yeah.
It's like a woman who just wants to do her ibadat and she doesn't clean her house.
Mm.
That is not moderate personality, right?
Definitely.
So never overdo it. And then don't teach Islam to show off.
Mm.
This is very important. Children should be taught that to be religious is not that the parents should be proud of you. They
okay.
should have the satisfaction themselves. This is very important.
You can you elaborate?
Yeah, I can elaborate this way that, you know, this feeling that when you go there, I want people to say that, look, so-and-so's daughter or son is, mashallah, so, you know, good hijab.
Yeah, so Islamic, mashallah.
So Islamic, so well-mannered. No, this is for your own betterment.
Yeah.
Teach that, inculcate that in them. And of course, parents can do that by encouraging also the child at home and not praising them outside too much,
yeah.
like near people, that my daughter did this, or she's finished, for example, reading a Quran in the month of Ramadan. She did this, so that the child can keep on. Now then the child will depend on people's praises and they'll feel that this is the only good outcome that comes,
mm.
you know. And they won't get that, there won't be time for getting that own satisfaction through doing that action.
Yeah.
So that's very important to teach them that how do you feel when you do that?
Yeah.
That's very important.
Because then they'll feel like, okay, whenever they do an action, they'll be waiting for the praise. If the praise doesn't come, they don't do
yeah,
that action.
Yeah, exactly. Then yeah. they'll feel that today no praise came, so I didn't do it properly. So I leave now
yeah.
doing this thing. It's no use because maybe it wasn't good enough.
Mm.
So it should be done in such a way that the parents should feel that you, your Lord is pleased with you. You know, it takes away so many other diseases of the heart also, that I-ness in you, that boastfulness, you know, that bragging nature, that I'm doing this, I'm doing that, that wanting to keep your own good deed as a secret
yeah.
in future, which is a very good thing, that you never let out your good deeds to people. And you don't, you know, even if you recited, for example, the Tahajjud prayers, you shouldn't, you know, you should
yeah.
keep it a secret, right?
Because you did it for Allah. You wanted
exactly.
to be...
Allah will give you the reward
yeah.
of it. And Allah is, you know, more powerful than and more richer than everybody.
Definitely.
Right? Yeah. You can't even compare that. So anyway.
That's very interesting, inshallah. So we're just going to stop for a short break and we'll continue with this discussion. Please stay tuned.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat. Ya muqiya al-khayrat.
The Prophet ﷺ said, a righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. We were discussing on how we want to train our children to be raised Islamically, and we should be aware of what not to do.
Right.
So we mentioned some of the don'ts, and you mentioned that we shouldn't overdo, for example, the things that the child doesn't want us to do, even if they're good things. For example, recommended acts. If we overdo it, then the child will feel like she's not giving enough time for me, and, you know, I don't like that act. And also, we don't want to teach Islam in a way that it's for show off. So the child shouldn't feel like doing things just so that other people can praise and that, you know, oh, people should know that they're such a good person. But it should be inculcated that it's for the child's own betterment and he's doing it for Allah. And slowly, slowly, that would become, you know, inculcated.
And last but not least, don't make Islam a burden in general. Some parents, you know, they portray Islam in such a way that it's very difficult. For example, they don't prepare the children for first, and then when the time comes, they say, oh, now you have to do it. If you don't do it, you know, this will happen. So it becomes a burden. So inculcate them from a young age to have this happiness in doing it.
So it will come naturally.
Yeah, it shouldn't become a burden. So, you know, even when you feel that it's a burden on them, for example, certain rules like performing of hijab and fasting and such rules, that you pass that energy to them. They will also feel, yeah, it's a very big burden. I can't, for example, fast for 16 hours. Even the long days, they are proven. Near my eyes, I know of children who have fasted.
Yeah.
So 16 hours is not a big thing. But when parents give them this feeling of Islam being a burden, then that feeling will, of course, naturally come within a child, that Islam is a burden.
Yeah.
So never feel that Islam is a burden. Don't make Islam a burden for them. Make it very light-hearted, very enjoyable for them.
Very
easily reachable and very much within our capacity.
Yeah.
Okay? So that the child can be encouraged. And that's why certain principles have to be shown and taught from a very young age, the way I mentioned, like hijab and prayers, for example, salat, and with joy, so that they cannot forget the feeling it first brought about to them. This is very important. Mm. You know, first of all, what feeling did this bring about to you?
Yeah.
For example, praying, you know, like after that, the parents take her to the park or the shop to buy some toy. So she'll always think, or he'll always think, that going to the mosque, after that we have a ride, a small ride, or to the park or to the shop, or, you know, to buy something. And we have an outlet for ourselves, right?
Making them look forward to it.
Yeah, I would like to share some wise words here.
Okay.
That a virtuous child, because we want to raise our child Islamically and we want to follow these things, that we should not do the don'ts. We should do the do's and leave the don'ts. So that makes a virtuous child come into being. Is like a fragrant flower. And these are from the flowers of heaven. And this is taught by our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
That's very beautiful, mashallah. The hadith is very beautiful. I think generally we just have to be careful on what we should not do, because if we do them, then our children are not benefiting, and they're just going to not look at Islam the way it is. Islam is so beautiful, but I feel like because of our lack of knowledge, we made it very limited. Well, Islam is so wide and it inculcates everything. We just have to...
It's a complete way of life.
Yeah,
right?
We just have to enhance that, you know, this
outlook
exactly for the children, and slowly, slowly, as you said, from a young age, then inshallah they will grow up and they will, you know, realize
become
that
this virtuous child, like a, you know, fragrant flower and spread the smell, you know, in every part of the...
Yeah, very true. Inshallah. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us today, Sister Salma. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irrb.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
IRIB English Radio.